I remember my dad very young being like, you have to get comfortable with no, and it's not going to be fun. Now I'm at a point where I've really learned how to process it and not let a no or a rejection affect my view of myself.
It also gave you the confidence to approach Leonardo DiCaprio and Benicio del Toro and say, will you make a TikTok with me? How did that happen?
I just go, do you want to make a TikTok with me? And then I show them the trend. Like, it honestly was like a lot easier than I thought it was going to be.
Interesting.
It was a lot easier than I thought it was going to be.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of The Envelope. You have myself, Kelvin Washington, alongside my usual suspects, Yvonne Vidal, Mark Olson as well. It's been a week, so I'm trusting everybody's good.
Doing great.
Good. All right. So, Yvonne, I'm coming to you here because you're going to help us break this down. You don't buck the eyes. Yes, we're coming to you. The Academy, they're making some changes when it comes to the live broadcast, and it can be a little bit confusing. That's why we got you here. Tell us more.
Yeah. So they announced that they will be moving 5 categories that are usually handed out during the ceremony, the primetime ceremony. They're moving them to a week prior and handing them out during the Creative Arts Emmys weekend. And it's causing a lot of stir, but they say, you know, the decision is sort of to make space to innovate the live show and incorporate new things. You know, viewership is always something that they're after. But it's causing a stir in Hollywood because, you know, we're losing some, you know, mainstays of the show. And that's writing for a variety series, but also taking a big hit is a limited series or movie categories. We're losing supporting actors, supporting actress, but also writing and directing. And people have a lot of thoughts. Mark, I want your thoughts. Kelvin, I want your thoughts.
I feel like there's a disconnect between the people who watch award shows and the people who make and produce award shows, where I feel like those of us who watch them, we just want more sort of genuine moments from the talent, from the nominees. Like, I want more speeches.
Yeah.
And right. So like taking away 5 categories, so there's going to be that much fewer speeches. Like, I just can't help but think of like Linda Cardellini, who's in one of the people nominated. You know, she was on our roundtable earlier this year and just like a great presence, a stalwart, you know, TV, you know, actor. And to take away that chance for her to get up, you know, potentially get up on stage, be really genuine. Like, why would you not want that as part of your show? Instead, having these kind of like canned comedy bits or, you know, hacky reunions plus canned comedy bits that nobody particularly wants.
Well, and it's an awards show.
True, but maybe I'm nobody in this case. I mean, I do enjoy, we talked about, you know, we were talking about this a little bit earlier. You guys were making fun of the 90s reunions. I enjoyed it. You know, I enjoyed seeing, I think it was maybe 2 years ago when they had Martin up there and they had never been invited to. They were kind of a little joke in there. They say, oh, we never got invited or we never won an Emmy. And so I think it's been pretty cool. And I will say that this is the challenge for productions when you're trying to appease everyone. Is it about the awards? Is it about the length of time? Just speed this thing up? Is it about having the magical moments? And then you see the Grammys try to get these things right as well. It's always, you're never going to be able to please everyone. So I think it's always a difficult balance. So we'll see how it works out this year. But I'm looking at you, Mark. Just, you know, some people might enjoy those. And you too. Those nerdy little reunion shows.
Maybe it's also like in a time when it's already hard to get a show visibility in this marketplace. And so many people don't know what's nominated anymore. When you're taking away an access point for them to discover something or not tell them about a show, I think it's a short-sighted change, I think.
The only response I would have to that is that's kind of where we are. Even if you keep up with between television, movies, and music, it seems to be a lot more word of mouth than historically, where things were plastered everywhere. And you kind of, even if you didn't care about the particular thing, you saw it, you heard it. Now it's like word of mouth and just water cooler or just algorithm telling you what to like. All right. With that being said, somebody who's having a great run right now, Chase Infinity. I know you had a chance to speak with her. Of course, Handmaid's Tale did so well. Then there's a spinoff, The Testaments. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about your chat with her.
Yeah, I mean, talk about like a breakout nomination this year. Chase has really been a star on the rise. She made her, you know, debut in the Apple TV's adaptation of the legal thriller Presumed Innocent, playing Jake Gyllenhaal's daughter. And in recent projects, she's played this, you know, young revolutionary, both in Paul Thomas Anderson's One Battle After Another, but now in The Testaments, which takes place after the events of The Handmaid's Tale. And she's the daughter of a high-ranking commander, but she's also the biological daughter of June, who's Elizabeth Moss's character. And this show is really about seeing the rebellion of young teenage girls and how they are sort of key to the inside resistance of toppling this regime. And so we talked a little bit about that.
All right. Well, you got me a little nervous. You talk about the rebellion of teenage girls. You know, I've got a 9, a 7, and a 5-year-old. So that could be my future. Yeah. At
Let's
some
hope
point.
It is. Right. They are the future.
All right. You're right. You're right. Yvonne and Chase, here they are now.
Chase, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations on your Emmy nomination.
Thank you.
What do you want to remember about this moment, this feeling?
Oh, I don't know. I think, like, I'm trying to take little pictures in my brain of everything and remember all of the kind of influx of emotions that I felt that entire time, but also throughout, like, the whole journey of making season one of The Testaments, because there's so many things about it that I'm like, I just never want to lose that feeling, because there's a lot of moments I had on set and also during the press tour, and then even, like, finding out about the Emmy nomination, which feels very crazy to say, but even finding out about that, like, there's so many little things that I'm like, I never want to lose that feeling. I want to keep it in my brain forever.
Well, I was curious, like, is it as thrilling as what you remember feeling when you booked that first role in a local production of Hairspray when you were 10? Like, I imagine it still feels like that for you.
It definitely does. And, like, I think that a lot of it is, I mean, I also feel very grateful that with my job and with everything I get to do, like, I really try to keep intact how much I love the work and how much I love creating. And I think that that's what helps it keep that same energy as me finding out I'm playing Crystal in Hairspray versus me finding out that I have an Emmy nomination.
Were you on cloud nine getting the news of Crystal?
Yeah.
Were you just going around town being like...
I was, because I was so happy, because it was the first time I ever had a name in a musical. And I remember I would, when I was a kid, I watched the movie version of it every night.
For 6 months.
Yep. Not a lie. Me and my sister would turn it on religiously after school. And we would start singing Good Morning Baltimore. It got to the point where we knew, like, almost every line in the movie.
Which I feel old asking, which version of Hairspray, the Zac Efron? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it about it?
It's just catchy. Mm-hmm. Like, everything about it, it just makes me happy. I don't know. And then when I hear, like, Run and Tell That, I just want to do twirls in my room whenever I hear it. I don't know. I love musicals so much, and they make me so happy. And if I'm ever, like, down or need a little pick-me-up, I'll literally just blast, like, that soundtrack. I'll blast the soundtrack to, like, Pippin or anything that, like, really, or Shrek the musical especially. Just, like, stuff like that I remember, like, being in the production, and it kind of, like, brings me back to those happy memories I had, or productions that I saw that I was like, oh my gosh, this really, like, makes me want to work towards being in something like that. So I love musicals.
Well, I mean, it was just 2 years ago where the general public was starting to learn your name with your debut in Apple TV's Presumed Innocent, which I still tell people to watch. And we won't talk about the ending because I don't want to spoil things. But since then, I mean, you've navigated the film award season, TV award season with One Battle After Another and now The Testaments. And I imagine, like, it's a whirlwind, right? Being thrown into the deep end, you're suddenly, like, sitting across from these stars, talent that you've seen and admired over, you know, your life. And also having your work sort of processed and looked at. How do you make sense of what this moment is? Are there still things you're getting used to? What have you sort of enjoyed about this part of the job?
There's a lot of things I'm still getting used to. I think, especially with One Battle, I think the biggest adjustment I had was people knowing me before I walked up to them, and like people that I'm massive fans of. Mm-hmm. Like I think
Give me an example.
I met Angela Bassett at something, and she came up to me and said my name, and I was like, "You're Angela Bassett, and you know who I am." And I think that that was like a, oh my gosh, like stuff mm-hmm. like that, where I'm really just like, that's, I'm still really adjusting to that, and I have a, I feel like there's a disconnect in my brain between like what I think people know of me versus what reality actually is. And my friends bring it up all the time, and they're like, "Chase, like these people know who you are." And I'm like, but I can't wrap my head around that. Like that's, mm-hmm. it's very strange, especially going from like a 0 to 100 situation. So I think that that's something that I'm still trying to find an adjustment on in my brain, but I've gotten to meet like all of my superheroes in a way, like mm-hmm. all the people that I've grown up watching on the screen and on the stage, just all of these different events and in passing, and everyone could not be kinder. And just getting to meet them and just pour into them how much they've shaped my life and shaped the creative work I want to do. But then also another adjustment thing is kind of hearing them kind of pour back into me too. And then I think that's something that I've been getting used to, but I think meeting the superheroes of it all in my brain has been, that's been something I've really loved. But then also getting to meet people who've watched The Testaments, mm-hmm. like younger girls who've watched it and then really found a connection point with it. It's had an impact on them mm-hmm. and an impact on them and their friends. And I think that that's something I really cherish about getting to do what I get to do. Because I had it with One Battle, and then it's really cool to see it happening again with The Testaments. So that's like, I feel like that's a very wonderful gift I get to face very often.
Before we delve further into The Testaments, I do want to point out this moment on stage at the Academy Awards, which is when One Battle After Another won Best Picture. Mm-hmm. And Paul Thomas Anderson singled you out, calling you my American girl and the heart of this movie. Place me in that moment as Chase.
I didn't hear him. I just heard him say my name. Uh-huh. And so I thought it was kind of just like, because I remember he was going down the list and saying names of different people, and I thought it was something like that. And so, like, I was touched that he even mentioned me on stage. And I was touched that he, I mean, obviously that movie has quite literally changed my life and that entire cast. And I love Paul so much. And so I didn't hear him on the stage. And it wasn't until afterwards that my parents had sent me like a screenshot of the captions mm-hmm. from that night. And they were like, "This is what Paul said about you." Cause I told him, I was like, "Paul said my name, but I didn't hear what he said." And they sent it to me. And I just remember like just feeling so honored that I got to be a part of something that changed my life, but also really, I think, changed a lot of people's lives as well. And they connected with it, but also like that job will always, I can distinctively remember every single day on that job. And I think that just getting to see the full circle moment of it, right. Like, I just remember feeling such a rush of emotions after reading that, because like, I love that movie and I love Paul so much. And I could not be more grateful for that opportunity and for the opportunity to play Willa, and let alone like get to be a part of the crazy world that is a Paul Thomas Anderson set. But I learned so much, and I don't know. There's so much I could say about it.
Well, how did playing Willa inform how you thought about Agnes, who's also this sort of young revolutionary mm-hmm. in the making, as you were thinking about your putting yourself on tape for The Testaments?
I think, well, when I got the script for The Testaments, I only had one script. And mm-hmm. then so I signed on to it with one script in mind. And obviously I had like read the book beforehand, mm-hmm. so I had an idea of what she was going to go through, but I didn't necessarily know how it was going to pan out on screen. Mm-hmm. But I think the biggest help with Willa beforehand going into that is I feel like I by nature have a little bit of a rebellious spirit, but I really had to turn it up with Willa. Mm-hmm. And I think that just being able to access that through Willa and then shape it differently for Agnes, mm-hmm. given the circumstances of where she is. Right. I think that that was the biggest key between the two, because they do share this strong sense of rebellion. Granted, Agnes doesn't know where it comes from. She doesn't really know how to handle it necessarily. Mm-hmm. But I think that that was a nice way into Agnes and creating her world mentally of where she is, and also the inner turmoil of, I know that there's this thing happening inside me, but I don't really understand it. But that, I think, was the biggest cheat code from Willa to Agnes.
What was it about the testaments that was something that spoke to you and made you want to go after the material?
I mean, the show is when I got my one script mm-hmm. that I like, just from that one script alone that I read before I signed on, it was hidden that it was The Handmaid's Tale, but you can kind of get a sense of what the world is based off of that initial script. And I just fell in love with how detailed it was. Mm-hmm. And I think that it didn't feel like there was any question marks in the world. And I think that diving into something that felt very interesting, because it's not otherworldly, but it feels otherworldly in the sense of like the way that they speak and the way that Gilead itself, I guess, the appearance looks on paper versus on the screen. And I think that that was something that I found to be very interesting. But I think with Agnes specific, I really loved the amount of love that she has for her friends, because mm-hmm. that's something that I feel very strongly about, like my friends and my family, but especially my friends are like the people I cherish most in my life. My loved ones are like near and dear to my heart, and I will do anything for them. So I think that that's something that I loved about Agnes. And I was like, that makes me very happy to see that even in a world that's so dark and so dim, even if she doesn't view it as that, it is dark and it mm-hmm. is dim for a young girl in Gilead. She still has so much love and so much hope for her friends. And I found that to be very inspiring.
Did you have any hesitation about sort of living in this kind of world, or knowing that there was the element of hope with these young girls make it sort of more palatable for you? Or how were you feeling about the heaviness of the subject matter?
I don't think that that necessarily terrified me, because I think that I have this very privileged ability to step into this world that seems like it's so far outside of what we are, I guess, used to, but it's really not. There's mm-hmm. there's situations that happen in the show that, well, I'll start by saying nothing that Margaret Atwood writes is fiction. It is all based off of history or things that are happening at the time that she has written it. So going into it, I knew that it was going to be very relevant. Like, going back to what I was saying, I'm in this very privileged position to where this isn't my reality, but this is the reality of so many women around the world. And I thought that when I read this script, that this was a way for people to not, I guess, become desensitized mm-hmm. to seeing these things, because I think that we're in a world where it's so easy to just turn off your phone, scroll past something, and just ignore what's actually really happening. But with the testaments and with the things that these girls go through, like, I truly feel heartbroken for the amount of things that they go through. But if this in any way can wake people up, can help people continue to ask questions and really question their own environments, I think that that was something that I wasn't scared of. And I really felt empowered to join something that was doing that. And I am also grateful that on that set, it never felt like the material was too heavy for a day, because our entire cast and our entire crew kept the energy on set very light. And if there was ever a point where a day was extra heavy, I knew that I could turn to Lucy and she would always be there for me. I know that I could turn to one of the directors and they would always be there for me, or even one of the PAs. Everybody mm-hmm. on set was very forthcoming with kindness and just always very open. And I think that that was something that helped to keep the heaviness of the subject matter not going home with us, if that mm-hmm. makes any sense. Mm-hmm. But that's a long-winded answer. But
Agnes has only known obedience mm-hmm. and repression. Yeah. And we see how it's sort of expressed in her posture. She would mm-hmm. probably hate my posture right now.
she would hate mine too most of the
and,
time.
And, you know, she's very controlled with mm-hmm. her emotions. And as somebody with roots in musical theater, mm. Did you have to curtail some of those instincts that you might have had to sort of be a little more expressive? Like, how was it settling into Agnes?
I want to say it was honestly pretty easy, because you get into the space, you get into the world, and you instantly are kind of transported, and you get little context clues based off of the things that you see in Agnes's room, or versus the things that you see in the school, or the absence of things. And I think that the absence of things really helped to start to put me in a box, in a way of what, or not in a box, that's not the negative connotation of that, but in a box, in a way, like putting the costume on, it really helped for me to feel the restriction of the world, and for me to understand what Agnes's mind is, and getting to see that from the outside and then getting to step into it, I think that it wasn't that hard to kind of, I guess, shut off that part of my musical theater brain. But also, I think, like, part of that is also I've learned how to maneuver through that, just based off of, like, Presumed Innocent and One Battle, because both of those parts are also very, very much so not musical theatery at all, especially Jaden. Like, that was also something that I had the privilege of learning on both of those sets.
Well, something that stands out with Agnes is we're witnessing her awakening, and, you know, Gilead is all she's ever known, and she's very dutiful to, you know, the practices of that society, but she's grappling with, you know, coming into her identity and feeling this gap of, like, her internal version and what society tells her to be. And I'm curious, what was important to you in sort of having those two things live side by side, expressing that as her?
Baseline for me, for Agnes, the one thing I never wanted her to lose was her sense of love. And I think that she is a character who, that is at the root of most of her decisions, especially when it comes to the final episodes with Becca. I think that the love that Agnes has in this world is something baseline I never wanted to lose. And I really tried to maintain that throughout, at least from when I was tackling it. It really just felt like a part of real life. Mm-hmm. And because there's so much that you kind of keep to yourself, like your inner thoughts, your inner personality in a way, versus what you outwardly show the world. And I think that I just had to turn up the extremes when it came to Agnes. And really make sure to keep those things that she keeps close to her heart guarded, and put on this almost armor in a sense of what she views to be the most perfect version of herself for the outside world. And then watching that kind of crumble, those layers are peeled apart based off of, like, what happens to her and what she sees happen to her friends. But also, I think that there's a point in everyone's life where they realize, oh, what I had been raised under the belief of is actually not the reality. And whether it be something like that, or whether it be an idea or an ideal that you have about the world or about yourself or your morals, just based off of what you've been raised with, I think that everybody has a point in their life where they have to face a version of reality that they've been told versus what actually is reality in a way. And so I think a lot of that was just kind of turning up the extremeness, because those are all things that I think that we go through in life, whether you're 12 or whether you're 45 or 26 in my world, because there's things that I'm still learning and there's things that I still am questioning, just based off of what I see in my personal life. And then also with, like, my friends or what my family goes through.
A key character in the show is Menarche and the menstrual cycle. We see how it's weaponized, but we also see how it gives these young women, young girls, their power. Like, that's where it holds. What was that like to explore that? As, you know, we don't talk about it as openly as they do in Gilead.
Yeah.
And here it's, like, just normal.
Yeah.
We talk about it. What did you enjoy about that exploration of that key part of being a girl?
I think the thing I honestly really enjoyed about it is the openness of it. Because I think that, like, at first you kind of have that, the, like, you know, when you go to the bathroom and this is perfect podcast talk, but you know when you go to the bathroom and you have like you're taking your pad or your tampon, whatever, to go change whatever, but you're kind of hiding it because you're like, oh,
even
I don't
though
want,
we're all
I don't know if I want anybody to see it, but then like
the
getting
crinkling.
On
yes.
the crinkling of everything, but like I think that the openness of everything in the show, granted like circumstances are completely
right.
different, but the openness that they have with it I found to be very freeing and refreshing in a way. And I think that that was something, especially when we started shooting, that we all talked about, because we were like, we've never been in a place where it didn't feel like there was a stigma against it. Like mm-hmm. it felt like we were almost encouraged to talk about it. And I think that like getting to put this show out into the world and letting girls see that it isn't something that they should be afraid of, but also letting them see that this is normal. This is not something that we should be scared of, let alone, try to hide, because it's a part of womanhood. It's about becoming it's also a part of girlhood and a mm-hmm. point of connection between younger girls mm-hmm. and I think that getting to see it on the screen and see the way that these girls talk about it, ignoring the society of Gilead and the amount of pressure that the men put on them mm-hmm. in this society, I think that that connection that they have with those few things that span across culture, across any culture in the world, that is something that we were all very happy to kind of have that openness with, something that we've all felt so scared to talk about, especially at like 14 and 15.
Scared to experience
yeah.
for the first time.
Because I remember when I got my period for the first time, I was like, what is happening? I don't know what is going on.
Terrifying.
And like the first person that you call, if it's not like your mom or if it's not like another maternal figure in your life, is your friends.
Yes.
Because they're normally the person closest to you in proximity, like if you're at school or if you're like, I don't know, at an after school activity or mm-hmm. something like that. And I think that just getting to have that openness, like that felt very refreshing to have on set.
Well, there was so much openness that there was a Monarchy playlist.
Yes.
Tell me about this. Curated by director Mike Barker.
Yeah.
Tell me about this.
We were doing a camera test for the costumes, and I remember Mike just putting on this playlist, and he's like, I like putting out there these songs for like everyone to listen to, because there was like no dialogue mm-hmm. in this little camera test between, it was like me, Mateo, Rowan, Lucy, Brad, Amy, and Mabel. I can't remember if I might be forgetting somebody else, and I'm so sorry if I am. Mm-hmm. But it was a bunch of the cast, and then there was also some Pinks in there just to see how
yeah.
everything looks on camera. And we were hearing like all these different songs playing, and we were like, wow, this is great. Like, thanks for putting together a playlist, Mike. And I think at some point, like Lucy like went to grab his phone to look at like what the song was, and his like I don't remember what app it was, but his playlist was open. And she's like, why is a playlist called the Monarchy playlist? And after that, like, it just became like a bit of us trying to get him to approve a song that we would suggest. If
what did you suggest? I just remember you sharing that Britney Spears' Baby One More Time
yes.
was on it.
I think that was like the first song okay. on it. But like, we would be like, there would be points in lunch, because we'd all eat lunch together. And we'd be like, okay, Mike, like, what about this one for the Monarchy playlist? Or like, what about this one? And we would like all secretly hope that like they would get added to the show.
Did one of yours get added?
None of
to at least the playlist? No.
You know, there are songs on there that I don't even remember. So one of them probably did get added. I just don't remember what it was.
It's sort of heartbreaking that Agnes is somebody that doesn't really experience culture.
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't know, like, a musical artist. Mm-hmm. We don't know what kind of music she likes, mm-hmm. what kind of TV or film she
yeah.
likes. And you're someone that's very much, like, into culture, at least from what I've seen. Were you thinking about what she might like, or how did you think about her backstory? Because I know you do think about backstories for your character. Did you think about that, or what was important to you in looking at that?
With Agnes's backstory specific, was really just relying on what you saw of her in The Handmaid's Tale. Mm. And that was kind of the extent of what I would let a part of her backstory be. Mm. Because I was like, she doesn't remember much about her childhood. And then once she gets kind of, once she becomes conscious in a way mm-hmm. in Gilead, I really, all I did was rely on the things that I knew that she liked and really try to remind myself, she doesn't know what a movie is. She doesn't, I mean, she knows what Jaws is, mm-hmm. but she doesn't really have an understanding of like what watching a movie is like. She doesn't, mm-hmm. she doesn't know what YouTube is. She doesn't know what a phone is. And I think that I had to keep reminding myself, especially at the beginning, to not put those things in the forefront of our mind. Unless, of course, like you're a Pearl yeah. girl who has, I guess, like prior knowledge of everything. But a lot of it was just reminding myself, you don't know what this is. She doesn't know what this is. A lot of the things that, like, if I were to meet Agnes right now, she would probably think I was crazy. Like, she would probably think I was really crazy because she just doesn't understand a lot of the things that I've seen, the things that we use in our day-to-day life. And I really tried to make sure to keep that intact. But also relying on the bits of information that I had from The Handmaid's Tale, going back to the show. And also, of course, we had Bruce Miller, so I could ask him anything.
What would you, Chase, expose her to? Like, what if she were to come to you asking, what should I be listening to, watching? What's the guide you'd give her? The crash course.
The crash course? Just to, like, being like, 14?
Yes.
I would show her One Direction. I'm sorry. I would show her One Direction because that is something that is so quintessential being like a 14-year-old, especially like me being 14. I would be like, Agnes, I see the things that you love and you're obsessed with. I'm going to show you the thing that I was in love and obsessed with when I was your age.
Who would she go for in One Direction?
I have no idea. I think she would just be overwhelmed by like what is... I don't even know. I'm just trying to even think of like, what would I even show her? Like, would I just play the music? I think, I don't know. I would be very curious to see how she would react to, like, hearing One Direction for the first time. Like, hearing What Makes You Beautiful, that would be very interesting to see. But I think I would show her something that is, like, representative of, like, me being her age. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I still am a fan. I've always been a fan my whole life. But especially, like, One Direction, that's probably something I would show her.
Well, tell me about who Chase was at 14, because you talked earlier about having a little bit of that rebellion in you. Mm. But especially after playing these two characters back to back, what have you sort of learned yourself about your power or finding your voice, especially in an industry like Hollywood? Mm.
Something that I realized this when I was probably about 13 or 14, is... I used to be very upset when people would underestimate me. And then I kind of found a way to, I guess, not make it my superpower, but use it as opposed to something that would, I guess, defeat me, use it as something to continue to motivate me to working towards like the goal that I already had. Because there's always going to be people that underestimate you. There's always going to be people in the world that want to pour negativity into you when you're truly just living your life, working towards the things that you want. And I think that, like, that was something that I realized pretty young, because I knew at like 10 that I wanted to be an actor. And so at that point, I kind of made a shift in my mind where I was like, okay, I need to start working towards a thing that I want to do. And I think that, like, at 13, people were like, why are you so motivated to do this? Like, it's a bit embarrassing that you want to be an actor. Like, what makes you think you can do that? And I was like, because I want to do it. So I'm going to do it. Like, I never had a doubt in my mind that this would be the thing that I would get to do, because that was something that my parents always told me. They were like, dream big, because the dreams that you're imagining can be your reality, especially if you work hard enough towards it. And I feel very lucky that I get to do the thing that I've always dreamed of doing. But I think, like, learning how being underestimated can be used to, I guess, can be used as a motivator in a way.
How does that live side by side with also learning how to deal with rejection so young? Especially, I mean, you've been auditioning since you were 10, 11.
Yeah.
That's a lot to sort of process a young mind of, what does this mean? They don't like me. And learning that it doesn't mean that.
Yeah. It's a lot of tears, a lot of sad days, sad weeks, conversations with my friends, conversations with my parents. But like from that, from the being underestimated, I remember my dad very young being like, you have to get comfortable with no, and it's not going to be fun. It's not going to be something that you're excited to hear, because no one's excited to hear that they didn't get something that they really wanted. But I think that now I'm at a point where I've really learned how to process it and not let a no or a rejection affect my view of myself or affect my view of like a performance mm-hmm. or my abilities to do anything. I think that that's something, it took a long time to learn, and I'm still nowhere near perfect, but I'm definitely at a place that's better than when I was 13, because it is hard for somebody that young to get that amount of rejection. And then it's also hard for somebody at my age to handle that level of rejection, especially when you get so close to something. So I mean, I have to give that credit to processing those things to my parents, because that is all them. I had many tear-filled nights when I was a kid because I was so sad that I like didn't get a solo in something. Mm-hmm. And they're like, this doesn't mean that you're not talented. This just... And I'm also somebody who believes like the right things will find you. And they're also the people that kind of instilled that in me too. But they're like, this doesn't mean that you're not talented. This doesn't mean that people don't like you. It truly is, you put your best foot forward, take this as a learning lesson. And this isn't something that was meant for you. Even if it was something that you really wanted, there's a teaching lesson behind it.
Does it also give you the confidence to approach Leonardo DiCaprio and Benicio del Toro and say, will you make a TikTok with me? How did that happen?
I just go, do you want to make a TikTok with me? And then I show them the trend. Like, it honestly was like a lot easier than I thought it was going to be.
Interesting.
It was a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. But also, like,
you knew which one to go for, which trend was the least amount of work for them.
I was very specific. I did lots of research because I also was like, I want it to be something that, like, they can look at and also laugh at, you know? Yeah. Like, they can also enjoy it. And I think by the end of it, especially Leo, because he was probably in the most, I think that by the end of it, he really was having a good time.
Do you think you'll get there with Ann Dowd at TikTok?
I would love to. I don't know what it would be, but I would love to make a TikTok with Ann Dowd one day. Like, if it could be, like, all the girls on set making a TikTok, I would be very happy. I do have some planned.
Oh.
So we'll see.
We have to talk before we wrap things, but Margaret makes a cameo in the finale of season one. How do you even talk to Margaret Atwood when you meet her? What was that experience like for you?
Well, I mean, I think the person who was probably the most shocked, surprised was Lucy, because she's Lucy Halliday girl. Is the biggest Margaret Atwood fan I think I've ever met. And I had the gift of getting to witness Lucy meeting Margaret for the first time. But meeting her, she's so kind. And she also just has, like, her, Warren Littlefield says this all the time, where he's like, you can't talk to Margaret Atwood and not learn something with every conversation. And so I just remember, like, honestly being very quiet and just listening to her talk. And listening to her ask questions of me, ask questions of Lucy. But we also were very, we would just pour into her and be like, thank you so much for your work, because you truly have touched millions. But she's also so funny and like so witty and very like charismatic. And so honestly, I remember being very nervous beforehand, but she made it very easy to kind of, for our nerves to go away.
Nerves to go away.
Yeah. But I think the highlight was getting to see Lucy meet Margaret.
That's pretty sweet. Well, you're about to head out to Canada to start production on season two. You've seen, what, two scripts you said? What do you hope to see for Agnes in season two? And what can you sort of tease?
I think based on, I hope Agnes is happy. And I hope that she can continue to push and find her happiness. But I also... I hope that she doesn't lose her spark, and I hope that that's something that she continues to explore and understand why she is the way that she is. So I think that those are two hopes that I have.
The slow-mo walk from the finale. Come on.
It felt epic. It felt so epic getting to do that. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching playback and I was like, guys,
We're in good hands with these girls. Yeah, we're in good hands with them.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much and congratulations on this moment you're having. It's amazing. It's great talking to you.
Great talking to you too.
All right, that's it for this episode. Make sure you join us next week. We're going to have Matthew Reese from Widow's Bay and The Beast in Me. You don't want to miss it.